In this, our last module of our course on ACT for PTSD and other post-traumatic problems in living, I'll be reviewing the most important concepts from the overall course to work on solidifying your learning and giving you some last thoughts on your continued development as an ACT therapist so that you can take what you've learned here and apply it further. Acceptance and commitment therapy is a behavioral therapy based on functional contextualism. ACT is built on the premise that psychological inflexibility, including cognitive fusion, that is the inability to separate one's thoughts from oneself or reality, and avoidance of one's negatively evaluated internal experiences, underlies many forms of psychopathology. Psychological flexibility, on the other hand, is defined as the ability to fully contact the present moment and the thoughts and feelings it contains without needless defense and, depending on what the situation affords, persisting in or changing behavior in the pursuit of values and goals. This flexibility is viewed as a pivotal component of healthy human functioning, behavioral change, and resilience in response to stressful or traumatic life events. Psychological flexibility involves an open, willing, non-judgmental stance in relation to the full range of one's experiences, including, but importantly not limited to, trauma-related internal experiences such as intrusive memories, emotional distress, and physiological hyperarousal. This openness allows one the flexibility to make behavioral choices based on personally defined values, goals, and other contingencies, as opposed to being locked in a rigid struggle to try to control or avoid unwanted internal experiences such as trauma-related memories, emotions, imagery, and thoughts. ACT for PTSD seeks to bolster psychological flexibility through experiential activities, fostering willingness to approach, rather than avoid, a person's negatively evaluated internal experiences in order to increase valued, meaningful living. Within ACT, there are several core principles that underlie the work to be done. And because of its broad-based applicability, the main ideas within ACT can be applied to a wide variety of presenting problems that bring individuals to the therapy room. One of the principles that allows for that kind of flexibility is ACT's focus on pragmatism and workability. In plain terms, this means that the client's values are what determine the targets of treatment. The ACT therapist's job is never to judge whether or not a client's behaviors or choices are problematic. The marker of whether or not something in the client's life is a problem is the client's own determination of whether it is bringing him closer to or further from what is important to him and what he wants his life to stand for. This freedom from preconceived judgments or assumptions allows the therapist to truly work alongside the client. The ACT therapist does not simply settle for a reduction in symptoms as a marker of therapeutic success. Success is determined by the client's ability to live a life that he values, not determined by fleeting thoughts, feelings, bodily sensations, or even circumstances, including a history of trauma. Because even in the most trying of circumstances, individuals can choose to live by their own values. And the same thing goes for traumatic material. The goal is not to get rid of thoughts, feelings, and reactions related to a history of trauma, but rather to move life forward toward the client's values, even in the presence of that trauma-related material. ACT therapists have the honor and opportunity to assist their clients in reconnecting with those core values in order to live a more meaningful life. So some key points. Within ACT, we work on moving toward the client's chosen values rather than acting on fused thoughts or avoidance of unwanted private experiences, including those related to a history of trauma. The overarching goal is psychological flexibility, which allows the trauma survivor to move forward toward valued goals even when they are faced with trauma triggers for unwanted thoughts, feelings, memories, or bodily sensations. Although this course has focused primarily on the intervention components of ACT, it should be noted that effective ACT treatment rests on the bedrock of a solid initial assessment and case conceptualization. Assessment within ACT may be informal, like the assessment of the client's avoidance strategies, or formal, such as a standardized measure of experiential avoidance, like the Acceptance and Action Questionnaire, or AAQ. Further, some processes, such as values, can be assessed with either an informal or a formal method of measurement. One of the shared values within the community of ACT practitioners and researchers is that those kinds of tools should not be considered proprietary and should be made as widely available as possible. So measures like the AAQ and a variety of values assessment handouts and metrics are available free of charge at contextualscience.org. Although not central to the ACT model, therapists may also choose to use traditional measures of symptomatology as another source of information about a client's functioning, but not necessarily with the goal of reducing or eliminating those symptoms. Overall, the ACT therapist is committed to routine, ongoing assessment as a way of tracking progress, informing a case conceptualization, and guiding individualized treatment efforts. In addition to structured assessments, the ACT therapist works to generate an evolving functional assessment of the client's behavior and presenting problems in order to inform the course of treatment. To enhance these processes, ACT therapists also regularly use simple but effective modes of self-monitoring by the client, including diary cards, checklists, event logs on smartphones, and other ways of recording clinically relevant processes and behaviors in an individualized fashion. Many case conceptualization tools are available in print and online to assist an ACT therapist with identifying the most relevant targets for treatment across the six ACT core processes. Overall, case conceptualization can be seen as comprising multiple domains. First, information regarding the client's current presenting problems. Next, an analysis of the past situations that may have shaped the client's current problems. Next, a review of the current situations and circumstances that maintain the current problems. Next, a specification of the short and long-term goals for therapy. And finally, details of an evidence-based treatment plan to address those issues. An ACT-inspired case conceptualization is designed to be more focused on cross-cutting functional dimensions like experiential avoidance and cognitive fusion, rather than specific symptoms or diagnostic profiles. Those dimensions are guided by the six core ACT processes, the lack of each of which can cause significant problems in living when they contribute to psychological inflexibility rather than flexibility. Several other potential benefits of acceptance-based treatments like ACT arise from its transdiagnostic approach. So the case conceptualization should always go deeper than just a five-axis diagnosis. There are compelling theoretical and pragmatic reasons why transdiagnostic treatments may offer benefits for individuals struggling with PTSD. In fact, this may be especially relevant to the treatment of PTSD, which is associated with high rates of comorbidity. As I've mentioned previously, acceptance-based approaches can be applied to several presenting problems simultaneously without needing to determine and target the primary disorder. Further, addressing the full range of a client's presenting concerns using a transdiagnostic approach may promote treatment satisfaction and engagement compared to diagnosis-specific approaches. Although the rationale for taking a transdiagnostic approach in treating PTSD is strong, we still need more controlled research to determine whether it indeed provides these benefits compared to current first-line PTSD treatments. So some key points. Case conceptualization is a core step in executing ACT with trauma survivors. This includes not simply determining which diagnoses the individual meets criteria for, but also what the contributing past and present contextual factors are that have led to the current presentation, along with a determination of which of the ACT processes are most in need of intervention for the person. Ongoing assessment using either traditional self-report measures or creative ways of tracking domains of interest will help the client and therapist together determine whether therapy is progressing in ways that are important. By initiating this process-driven case conceptualization process, the ACT therapist can maximize the transdiagnostic benefits of ACT on not just PTSD symptoms, but also the processes that may be contributing to co-occurring problems, such as alcohol or other substance use, self-injury, depression, or anxiety. There's no one particular sequence in which ACT concepts must be delivered. Even though many therapist manuals and treatment protocols may present the processes in the sequence in which they're described here, there's a distinct amount of variability in how the ACT tools and processes are presented and delivered across settings, presenting problems, and therapists. There aren't yet data to inform the question of whether it matters in which order the primary ACT concepts are presented. The more competent and flexible an ACT therapist becomes, the less discrete the six processes may appear in a given course of treatment or even within a given session. Sometimes it may be clear from the individualized case conceptualization which treatment targets are primary and should be addressed first. But at other times, the course is not so apparent. One heuristic that may be helpful to newer ACT therapists is the following. For clients who present to treatment with significant levels of distress, appear tired of the struggle, or who clearly state that they wish to change something in their lives, the therapist may want to begin with creative hopelessness and present the ACT core processes, beginning with creative hopelessness, control is the problem, defusion, and on for there. For clients who do not present with any immediate distress, appear emotionally shut down, don't see any negative consequences for avoidance, or are in treatment because it's mandatory for them, the therapist may want to begin to work with values and committed action. In this case, if avoidance or fusion is a significant problem, it will show itself to be a barrier to moving forward with action soon enough, and then the other processes of ACT can be engaged. Regardless of the sequence in which these concepts are presented, the basic question to the client is, could you choose to be willing to try something different if it would mean that you could move your life forward in a way that means something to you? In addition to the sequence of processes, the beginning ACT therapist may also wonder how to know when to present one metaphor or exercise over another in a therapy session. It's important to note that a multitude of ACT-consistent exercises and metaphors are described in this course and in every ACT book that you might encounter. The ACT therapist should not feel compelled to cover every one of these metaphors or experiential exercises with every client. In fact, it may be much more useful to choose a few representative metaphors that seem to resonate with the client that can be referred to over and over as a form of shorthand within the therapeutic dyad. Rigidly sticking to a defined set of interventions is likely to function more to unnecessarily increase the therapist's comfort than to actually address the needs of the individual client. The ACT therapist should be encouraged to try a variety of metaphors and interventions over time, and even to create new, novel, act-consistent metaphors that are designed to meet the needs and interests of a given client or set of clients. If your client is really into music, see if you can come up with a music metaphor. If they're really into cooking, see if you can come up with a cooking metaphor. If they ride motorcycles, you can do one focused on motorcycles. It doesn't matter what the content is. And in fact, the more that you can create metaphors that are designed to convey the ACT concepts in ways that the client can actually relate to, the more they're likely to stick. The primary reason that metaphors are proposed to be effective within ACT is because they call to mind concepts that are already familiar to the client and further apply them to the world of private events and behaviors. So if the therapist truly understands the principles behind ACT and can create metaphors that resonate with the client's lived experience, you know, sporting metaphors for the athlete or building metaphors for the carpenter, these metaphors will be likely to have more significance, stick better, and have more impact for the client. So some key points. There is no one sequence that should guide the order in which ACT principles would be presented for all clients. This is where your individualized case conceptualization will come in. Common sequences involve beginning either with creative hopelessness and control as the problem, or values and committed action. There is no one right answer. It depends entirely on your assessment of what has contributed to the client's presenting problems and therefore needs attention first so that the effects can cascade into forward momentum and client engagement. I want to be clear that although we've now worked through a whole course on how to apply ACT to post-traumatic problems like PTSD, there are several other effective psychological treatments for these issues. And I'm a big fan of evidence-based treatments like prolonged exposure, cognitive processing therapy, dialectical behavior therapy, and seeking safety. The well-rounded trauma therapist will make sure to have broad skills across these approaches, even if she plans to specialize in ACT. You'll want to have multiple arrows in your quiver of powerful treatment approaches, and you don't want to neglect the existing treatments just because ACT may resonate strongly with you. So, for example, I have frequently done cognitive processing therapy and simply adapted it so that during the parts around disputing dysfunctional thoughts, instead we approach that with a diffusion perspective. Or similarly, when doing repeated exposures in an exposure-based treatment, again, we work on that through an acceptance and diffusion lens, as opposed to one that is working on reducing symptomatology or helping anxiety go away. It's important to have those skills. It's important to have the skills around crisis survival and even some basic emotion regulation skills and emotion labeling skills from DBT. You want to make sure that you also are able to use those treatments and take what's useful for them as you apply ACT to the same problems. Another area for consideration involves taking the opportunity to become part of the broader ACT community. With the current state of technology, even the most remotely stationed clinician can become part of an online community of professionals who share an interest in the application of ACT around the globe. You can use these groups like a book club or reading articles, or it can serve a case consultation function, or it can simply provide a venue within which you can problem solve systemic implementation issues related to ACT. And truly, these days, even locality isn't a limiting factor anymore, given that everyone is so comfortable now with video conferencing technology that these kinds of consultation groups can be created virtually, even internationally, using free video teleconferencing programs. Information about online resources, including listservs and special interest groups, can be found at contextualscience.org. Many local chapters and special interest groups have been developed around the world and are associated with established professional organizations. In addition, wherever there are two interested ACT therapists who are within driving distance of one another, a local ACT peer consultation group can be formed. Therapists who want to learn ACT but without access to ongoing supervision and training resources can take heart. There's empirical evidence to support the idea that just being trained in ACT may be enough to make a clinical difference, even when the ACT therapist is not an expert and adherence and competence may not yet be fully present. There are data to show that even therapists who are only able to receive a limited amount of training or supervision in ACT may be able to positively impact the functioning of their clients. So some key points. Even if you're entirely taken by the ACT approach and can easily see how it can be applied to trauma treatment, I strongly encourage you to also be proficient in other evidence-based treatments for PTSD and related problems. The well-rounded trauma therapist needs to have a variety of tools that can be used with the complex presentations that trauma survivors often demonstrate. But just reading books and attending trainings is likely not enough. What reads well on the page will likely take a different form in person in treatment. Finding opportunities for peer consultation or ongoing professional consultation with peer-reviewed ACT trainers will help ensure that implementation is effective even when the client's presentation is complex and session developments are unexpected. In order to fully engage with the treatment process, ACT therapists must also practice their own committed action before, during, and after treatment sessions. For starters, therapists generally need to spend time preparing before sessions. For experienced ACT therapists, this may simply mean reviewing their notes from the previous session and refreshing their memory about the behavioral assignments the client agreed to complete before the upcoming session. However, for therapists who are new to ACT, significantly more preparation time may be needed. For example, therapists in training may need to prepare by reading ACT textbooks or articles or watching videos to understand how to sequence and implement treatment tasks, or finding other ways to see examples of ACT implementation using different therapeutic styles. Or they may need to practice delivering ACT metaphors and exercises out loud so they'll be prepared to do so effectively with the client. I always tell people who are training with me that it's one thing to think you know the metaphor. It's another thing to actually practice saying it out loud into the mirror in your out loud voice. You'll realize the places that you stumble, the places where maybe you don't actually understand the point of the metaphor that you're trying to convey. Practice, practice, practice. It really will help it go much more smoothly in session. One potential obstacle to engaging in this level of effort is therapists' perception that they don't have enough time in their day-to-day lives to do substantial amounts of learning and preparation on an ongoing basis or for any one given client. And it's possible that this is true. Therapists are often generous, dedicated people who are very engaged in meaningful activities in their lives, both professionally and personally. However, it's important not to use this reason on a regular basis. I mean, one of the meaningful activities in the life of a dedicated therapist is ongoing training and continuous learning. It's providing competent psychotherapy that alleviates the suffering of others and facilitates individuals' ability to move their lives forward. And to that end, therapists may need to mindfully prioritize their own valued activities in a way that allows them to devote sufficient attention to preparation for therapy. Preparation and learning are not distractions in the life of a therapist. They are an integral part of the life and work of a therapist. Of course, despite any amount of training and preparation, ACT therapists may sometimes feel stuck, and especially people treating trauma survivors who can be quite complex may feel stuck from time to time regarding how to effectively move a given client forward. In these cases, it may be helpful for the therapist to share this feeling of stuckness directly with the client. You don't always have to act like you know everything. If you're feeling stuck, chances are the client may be feeling stuck. And sometimes acknowledging that openly is one way to shake things up a little bit. Maybe an open discussion will identify new entry points into committed action. In addition, it can be validating for clients because then they see that they aren't the only ones feeling stuck. When handled skillfully, such an interaction can lead to increased connection in the therapeutic relationship. And if, despite sufficient training and preparation, and despite engaging the client directly, the therapist still feels stuck, it may be time to engage in peer consultation or formal clinical supervision in order to identify and address the barriers, including learning some new ways of addressing them. So some key points. In addition to client barriers to treatment effectiveness, there are also ways in which the therapist's engagement can affect the workability of the treatment process. Therapists should remain mindful about the extent to which their own psychological inflexibility or cognitive fusion may be getting in the way of providing the most effective treatment possible. ACT therapists should check in with themselves regularly to see if they're putting in the effort needed to prepare for treatment and be willing to notice if there are times that they are themselves feeling stuck and may need to try something different to get unstuck. And now I'd like to talk a little bit about therapist well-being and self-care, which is really, really important. I mean, it's important for all therapists, but especially when you're working with a caseload of trauma survivors. Because the therapist's own well-being outside of the therapy room can also affect his ability to fully engage the process of committed action and all of the other ACT processes with clients. For example, if a therapist is struggling in areas of life in which he isn't acting in alignment with his own values, he may be inclined to avoid in-session conversations about committed action and fail to fully explore his client's lack of follow-through on committed action. So if the client has been trying to commit to himself to exercise more or drink less and has been making commitments and then not following through on them, well, then going into a session where he's asking his clients how they've been doing on following through on similar or different things, but things that are challenging for the client that they've been committing to, the therapist may end up feeling a little bit hypocritical and so may avoid working with the client and asking those questions and pushing forward. Alternatively, if a therapist is feeling like he's been falling short in important ways recently, he may over-identify with clients' experiences of being a fallible human being and therefore choose not to push them to do something he can't do consistently himself, maybe out of misguided compassion. Because the therapist is over-identifying with the client's experience of how hard it is to move forward, and so may feel like it's the compassionate thing to do, not to challenge the client. And all of these challenges can be heightened for therapists who are experiencing professional burnout or feeling tired or listless or disconnected from the meaning of the work. In those kinds of situations, conventional wisdom would suggest practicing self-care, getting enough rest, and spending time on relationships and activities outside of work. And while an ACT approach would support these healthy choices, of course, as appropriate, it wouldn't necessarily encourage therapists to back away from stressful or difficult work situations. Of course, if there are structural or logistical problems in the work environment that can be addressed with practical problem solving, that should happen. If you have a terrible boss that's affecting your day-to-day work, yes, at some point you should consider whether that's the place you want to work. Or if the structure of your day is getting in the way of you being able to attend to your clients in a consistent way over the course of the day, look at those sorts of things. However, therapists experiencing burnout might also be productively challenged to reconnect with what's important to them personally and professionally about the work so they can regain a sense of meaning and vitality in conducting ACT. Through a combination of self-care, practical problem solving, and values clarification and recommitment, burned out therapists can hopefully find a better balance in attending to both their own needs and those of their clients. And all of these things that I've just talked about are even more the case with trauma therapists. It's really, really challenging and impactful work that we do as trauma therapists, but there's also a tremendously different extent of information and imagery we're exposed to. When you're hearing about rape and domestic violence and war and car accidents and natural disasters all day long, that will put a drain on you. It will change the type of imagery that's in your mind at random times of the day. And all of us, even if we're very emotionally open and we love what we do and we're willing to go there with our clients, at some point you only have so much emotional bandwidth. And so trauma therapists may find themselves not just burned out in the traditional sense, but also anxious or hypervigilant. And I want to normalize this. When you're exposed to hearing about the worst of what people can do to one another, it would be odd not to be affected by this. So if hearing about awful things that happen to people all day long then makes you a little bit more careful as you walk down the street and perhaps more vigilant to the people around you or safety in your surroundings, that's normal. Part of being a trauma therapist for a lot of people is having that heightened sense of awareness. And sometimes it may be useful. Sometimes it may be a little bit too much. But it's important to recognize that that can be part of what happens. And if you're noticing that that is getting in the way of your functioning or your day-to-day life, then again, maybe it's time to focus on the basics. Getting enough sleep, being in a consistent sleep routine, eating healthy food, not junk food or convenience food. Getting regular exercise and prioritizing finding ways to work that into your day. And if you find that you're so exhausted at the end of the day that you never get around to exercising, finding ways to maybe do it before work or take walks in between sessions and have breaks specifically to do that. Look at the amount of alcohol that you may be consuming, both because we know that's an emotional avoidance technique over time and because it can also affect your sleep. And then make sure that you're also getting enough social connection and finding ways to be with the people that you care about, whether it's physically or virtually, but picking up the phone, talking to people, and finding ways of staying connected to your friends, your family, and your community. Again, that can just help balance out when you're hearing about awful things all day long. You want to make sure that you also have plenty of good, normal, average, positive, and supportive things that are also happening in your day to balance some of that out. And again, if you're feeling stuck in the work that you're doing, or you feel like you're having too much overload and you need somebody to talk to specifically about what you're hearing in the therapy session, and obviously you can't talk to your friends and family about that in any detail, consider getting consultation or supervision, another professional who can help you share that emotional load and who can give you suggestions for how to get unstuck, maybe when things become overwhelming. It's also possible that if you've been doing trauma work consistently for a while, or if it's brand new to you and it really is emotionally draining, you may need to scale back your caseload for a while. Take some simpler cases. Make sure that not every case that you're seeing is a trauma case, so that you have some variety and it's not that level of emotional intensity in every session, one after another. And you know this, but I'm going to say it anyway. It's important for you to take care of yourself so that you don't burn out permanently and so that you can model effective self-care for your clients. Again, as I've mentioned many times in this course, they will be able to tell if there are things that are keeping you from being fully present with them. And one of those things can be burnout. So some key points. It's important to remember that the therapist's overall well-being affects not only the therapist, but also the therapist's ability to help clients. Therapists are great at taking care of others, but also need to watch out for signs of their own potential burnout. And especially when working with trauma survivors, the risk of being emotionally drained or burned out is even higher. And so the ACT therapist working with trauma on a regular basis needs to maintain awareness of his or her own personal functioning and make sure that they're practicing self-care just as much as they teach their clients to practice self-care. The majority of therapists around the world choosing to learn ACT will not have the luxury of training for multiple years with an expert ACT mentor, although a number of peer-reviewed ACT trainers who are willing to provide virtual ACT consultation can be found on contextualscience.org. For this reason, it is essential that interested clinicians have a basic roadmap for learning to implement ACT in more independent settings. Fortunately, there are now a variety of tools and methods of training for the therapist interested in learning to apply ACT principles in practice. Certainly, one of the first ways to begin to build an understanding of ACT is to read books and treatment manuals that have been developed by different authors. And a multitude of excellent references can be found with a simple Google search. Repeated presentations of the same information in different ways are more likely to lead to a nuanced understanding of the material. This applies to both written and video-based training aids. Multiple video recordings are now available in which an ACT trainee can see a variety of therapists approaching similar therapeutic issues in slightly different ways. This direct modeling is especially important so that new ACT practitioners can learn to discriminate form from function in the application of ACT. By seeing that the same intervention can be delivered differently by each therapist, or that the same concept can be conveyed using totally different language, therapists learning ACT can begin to develop flexibility in implementation and find their own therapeutic voice. Similarly, for those who are able to attend ACT training workshops in person or virtual but live workshops, it can be especially helpful over time to attend trainings provided by at least two different trainers. For example, one could imagine a trainee who attends an ACT workshop with a trainer who demonstrates ACT using a very specific interpersonal style. If the trainee's style is very different from that of the trainee may think that he could never adopt that way of speaking or being in therapy. However, one can competently do ACT from a wide variety of styles. It's important not to confuse one trainer or therapist's delivery style and personality with the ACT approach itself. So, reading ACT texts written by a variety of authors, or attending trainings and reviewing videos in which different ACT trainers are featured, can help promote flexibility in delivery and disentangle individual trainer effects from the requirements of the therapy itself. Annual conferences of the Association for Contextual Behavioral Science provide an excellent opportunity to hear about the most recent developments in ACT from a variety of international trainers. I always recommend that those who are new to ACT do challenge themselves to work through a specific protocol in sequence several times, preferably with focused supervision, until the model is learned. The first few times that you use a specific ACT protocol, the goal is to build adherence, the ability to correctly deliver the core ACT techniques in a planful way. Over time, with effective supervision or peer consultation, the trainee can progress from a state of pure adherence to a state of competence, in which he is more able to flexibly apply principles, techniques, and metaphors across both routine and novel clinical situations. However, it's important not to skip the step of practicing skills repeatedly until adherence is achieved. Otherwise, it's too easy to give in to human nature and only practice those pieces with which the therapist is already comfortable. ACT therapists have to be reminded that the only way to the other side of the swamp is through it, even when it comes to challenging oneself to learn new clinical skills. One way to measure progress in adherence and competence is to use the ACT Core Competency Rating Form. That can be found at contextualscience.org. This simple rating form can be used to assess therapist skills in the following areas: the ACT therapeutic stance, developing willingness and acceptance, undermining cognitive fusion, getting in contact with the present moment, distinguishing the conceptualized self from self as context, defining valued directions, and building patterns of committed action. Examples of specific competencies that you might find are things like the therapist avoids the use of canned ACT interventions, instead fitting interventions to the particular needs of particular clients, or the therapist is ready to change course to fit those needs at any moment, or the therapist can defuse from client content and direct attention to the moment. Depending on the resources available to the therapist, she may ask her supervisor or consultant to complete this form multiple times while watching or listening to recordings of the trainee therapist conducting ACT. Even if the therapist does not have a supervisor or consultant, she can complete the form for herself, assessing her own perceptions of her domains of strength and weakness, and identifying areas in which she could benefit from more training and practice. So some key points. As the new ACT therapist begins to familiarize him or herself with the treatment approach, it is important not to confuse the style or personality of a specific trainer with what ACT is. Instead, the trainee should take the time to read multiple books, watch multiple videos, and attend trainings with multiple trainers so that the clinician can begin to extract the core of ACT, rather than confusing a given trainer's personality or idiosyncrasies with the ACT model itself. By familiarizing him or herself with multiple exemplars and working through one or two specific protocols with clients, the new ACT therapist can begin to find his or her own genuine voice for delivering ACT. Now I'd like to give just a few last reminders about the therapeutic relationship and the ACT therapist's role in treatment. ACT has always placed great emphasis on the value of the therapeutic relationship. The ACT therapist's role is that of coach, advisor, and witness, but not of expert or guru. The ACT model is crystal clear in its analysis that the issues that bring clients to psychotherapy are simply variants on the struggles that all humans face, and this includes therapists. The ACT therapist should thus face this work with humility, humanity, genuineness, and radical respect for the client's values and experiences. Many therapists who are new to the ACT approach report that it's a relief not to have to pretend to have all the answers in a session. Instead, the ACT therapist works along with the client to identify strategies for the way ahead based on the core ACT theoretical framework. Therapists working from an acceptance-based perspective are aware of their own personal susceptibility to avoidance, judgment, and lack of mindfulness of their own thoughts, and seek consultation to help ensure that they maintain a willing, accepting, and open stance while conducting therapy. Most trauma survivors have been profoundly disappointed by people in their lives and are extremely sensitive to any sign of untrustworthiness or rejection. And the way that this affects the therapeutic relationship may be even more crucial in the treatment of individuals who have experienced interpersonal traumas. It's important for the trauma therapist using an acceptance-based approach to maintain a transparent and straightforward manner, because it's our clinical experience that trauma survivors have a notably heightened awareness of other people's feelings and behaviors. One way to build trust is to remember to allow the client to set the pace of therapy. Although I've been describing here a general sequence to follow, and the therapist can generally guide the pace at which new ACT-based content is introduced, in the end, the client is in charge of how much they will participate and respond to this content, especially when it comes to focusing specifically on trauma-related content. It's helpful to frequently ask for permission or ask the client whether they're willing to go further or talk about a specific memory or trauma-related issue. It may seem counterintuitive, but by allowing the client to say no and respecting their choices over time, you will build the trust that is needed for them to choose for themselves to go to those deeper places later on. So, some key points. The therapeutic relationship in ACT is always important, but this is even more heightened when working with trauma survivors. Building and maintaining a meaningful therapeutic connection comes with openness and transparency on the part of the therapist. Furthermore, as the therapist demonstrates over time that she can be trusted, it will allow clients to open up more and more so that they can face even the hardest things they have been avoiding and move forward in a new way, knowing that they're not alone in doing so. I'd like to thank all of you for coming on this journey of learning about how to use acceptance and commitment therapy with trauma survivors. I hope you've found the content useful and that it will allow you to open up and be present with your clients in a new way and use some new powerful tools with them. Acceptance-based interventions like ACT comprise a set of evidence-based approaches that likely represent a strong fit for many people living with the full spectrum of trauma-related health conditions, including post-traumatic stress disorder. It is probable that these interventions may benefit some people who opt not to access first-line treatments or who don't respond particularly well to traditional cognitive behavioral treatments. ACT may offer unique benefits beyond those of traditional PTSD treatments, like improving broadly applicable mindfulness skills and increasing engagement in valued life domains. Additional research in this area will address several key questions, including whether ACT adds effectiveness beyond what is provided by existing trauma treatments, whether the effectiveness of acceptance-based interventions may be equivalent to first-line treatments when factors such as client choice and treatment completion rate are considered, and the role of mechanisms such as mindfulness, psychological flexibility, and self-compassion in PTSD treatment. Finally, emerging evidence indicates that acceptance-based interventions are possible to deliver well through telehealth and other newer delivery mechanisms for a range of problems that frequently co-occur with PTSD. And recent experience delivering ACT for people with PTSD via telehealth indicates that this is an acceptable delivery method. Given the complexity of the mental and physical health challenges associated with trauma exposure, combined with the limitations associated with even the most well-established, efficacious treatments for PTSD, I believe that having a broad range of treatment options is important. Acceptance-based interventions, by virtue of their strong acceptability for many people and their transdiagnostic approach, represent an important set of options for promoting recovery in trauma survivors. Using ACT for post-traumatic symptoms and life problems is not for the faint of heart. In fact, it requires a big heart. The most effective therapists will be those who can both appreciate the depth of emotion and challenging thoughts and memories that are associated with a client's trauma history, and who can sit with them as they move through all there is, as the client learns that their history is not the enemy. And the time is now to move forward flexibly in whatever directions they most value.